This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in African Studies. Today, I'm speaking with Aaron Spencer Fogelman, who, along with his co-author, Robert Hansard, Associate Professor of History at Columbia College Chicago, created 500 African Voices, a catalog of published accounts by Africans enslaved in the transatlantic slave trade from 1586 to 1936. Aaron is a distinguished research professor in the history department at Northern Illinois University. This work from American Philosophical Society Press is a truly astonishing work featuring the thoughts and views of survivors of the transatlantic slave trade. This project is probably best understood as a digital humanities project. It is a research tool designed for students and anyone seeking out primary documents about the brutal experience of enslaved people. Aaron, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. You know, before jumping into the work, I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about yourself and your co-author, Robert Hansard.
Well, as you said, I'm an historian in the history department at Northern Illinois University. Years ago, Robert was a doctoral student there. That's how I know him so well. And Robert does Atlantic history as I do. But he is an Africanist. I am not an Africanist. So he is an Africanist who goes into the Atlantic world, and including North America, historically, and studies things from that perspective, whereas I'm an historian of early America, Atlantic world, who tries to incorporate all aspects of it, of the region, including Africa. And with this project, I've learned a great deal about Africa, but he is more of the Africanist expert than I am in many ways. And he wrote a dissertation years ago about the transfer of political culture from Akan peoples, especially in West Africa, to Jamaica and New York from the late 17th to the early 19th centuries, which is why I asked him to do this. I've written several books on transatlantic migrations, gender, religion, revolution, slavery, these sorts of things. And when working on another project, I began coming across all of these African voices, as we call them, and realized there were a lot more than most people and even most scholars and specialists realized. So it seemed it would be a good idea to write this book.
Could you give a brief overview of the book and how you sort of conceived of the project?
We call them African Voices. And the idea is, when dealing with transatlantic slavery, we want to get at the perspectives of the people, first of all, Africans, but not just Africans, people who were essentially victims, people who were thrown on the slave ships, was a lot of Africans were the merchants, monarchs and what sort of thing who were involved. And we have some perspective of them already, not enough, but some. And we had very little on the perspectives, what people said about their lives. A few and a growing number recently. But the idea was to find as many of these voices as we could in all languages, in all countries, in all regions of the Atlantic world, Europe, all of the Americas, the different parts of Africa, and make them available. And the key and the hardest part really was to develop a criteria and then apply it. So it became about first finding examples of African voices and then deciding whether or not they belong in our volume. And we stuck rigorously to that criterion, and I think that's what makes it valuable. When you read or use this book, you need to read the introduction. It's very important, where it explains criteria and many other things. But you really know what you have and what you don't have.
So what were some of the criteria that you used to determine what voices would be featured in this book?
First and probably most important, the voice needed to be from someone who was born in Africa. In almost all cases, not always, but almost all cases, they were born free. So it's someone who was born free and was thrown into slavery. They lost their freedom. So this excludes famous, important people like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs and many other people who were born in slavery somewhere in the Americas and wrote and published a slave narrative about it. So we're not including them. They're important in their own right, but we wanted the African element. The other important criteria was that they told their story to someone, and eventually that story needed to have been published. So we're not working with manuscripts and archives all over the Atlantic world. That would be too huge a project. That's not even feasible. So their account needs to have been published. It could have been published back in the day when they were enslaved. The publications we look at date back to the 18th century. It could also be a recent publication by a scholar. Some are very recent, 21st century. And the scholar was digging through legal or religious records of some sort and found an African voice and published it. And if that's the case, then we include it in our catalog. Another important criteria is that there's mediation involved. That's normal with published accounts. There's editors involved, there's publishers, there's interviewers. But the mediation needed to be limited. We needed to be sure that we were hearing an African voice, and we were not getting some kind of summary or description by, you know, a European or someone else of what the African was doing, or their activities, or their thoughts about it. And there's a lot of that, so it was very difficult sometimes to sort that out. The interviewer needed to have spoken directly with the African and should have recorded whatever it was they said, and that somehow gets published. And it didn't really matter how long it was. A number of these accounts of the 500 are full-length books, but that's just a small minority. Sometimes it's just a couple of sentences. But if it needed to reveal something about their life, either in Africa, on the slave ship, or at the destination, wherever they were taken. So if it reveals even in a couple of sentences something the African voice telling something substantive about their life, and it gets published, then we include it.
How did you go about collecting these interviews or these voices? Obviously, 500 is a lot. You know, what were the archives like when you were looking at them?
Well, the key to that is not the archives, but these are published accounts. So what we were looking for were not manuscripts and archives, although sometimes archives helped us. But we were looking for published material, articles in periodicals, books, pamphlets, and that sort of thing. So we used various means to find that, like one often does when looking for published materials. It began with a search of a well-known collection of slave narratives, and they were published as well. There were hundreds of them. It's online. And an undergraduate assistant looked through it to find out which were people who were born in Africa. And it was a small minority, but it was over 50. And that alerted me to something there, because most slavery scholars think that there may be 20 or 30 of these. Without trying very hard, with one undergraduate assistant looking in one place, we found over 50. And I thought that was very interesting. And then I began looking in a couple of other well-known collections. And in no time at all, I had over 100. And that's when I realized this was so much larger than anyone realized, that I needed to start a project to publish it. And so I kept looking and through well-known and not so well-known collections of slave narratives of all sorts, or document collections on the history of slavery or transatlantic slavery and that sort of thing. I began putting it together. I, with the help of others, there were a number of assistants involved with this, contributed along the way. But we looked, for example, through British parliamentary papers related to the slave trade, especially in the first half of the 19th century, when the British Navy was busy trying to intercept illegal slave ships taking people from Africa to Brazil or Cuba or somewhere else. They would intercept them and take most of them to Sierra Leone. And they produced a lot of documentation of that, including interviews of the Africans that they had liberated, as they put it. And also modern scholarly editions really beginning in the early 20th century, but especially in the late 20th century, people working on slavery would publish documents, and many of those included African voices.
So of the 490 voices that are featured in this collection, can you give our listeners a sense of maybe the broader demographic features of these people? Like, you know, when were they captured? How many were men? How many were women? What was in English or not in English? Whichever features you think are most relevant for our listeners.
Well, we have a large series of indexes in the back of the book that addresses that very question. And it's intended to help teachers and researchers who want to work on projects. So I think something like 17% were children when they were captured. They're all adults when they tell their tale when it gets published, and they may even be long dead by the time it's published. But at point of capture, and they're on the slave ship as a child, about something like 17%. And about 20% were female, women or girls. And that, you know, that's a small minority, right? But in the overall slave trade, only about one third were female. So it's pretty representative as far as that goes. And most importantly, in real numbers, 20%, that's roughly 100 published accounts by women. And most people, I've seen recent scholarly articles suggest that we have maybe two or three, but we don't. We have 100. So in a way, it's a lot, even though women are somewhat underrepresented. Chronologically, the first account, it runs the period, and it's in the title, the book 1586 to 1936. So the first account was recorded in 1586 in New Spain, what is now Ecuador. It doesn't get published until, I think, the late 20th century. But that's how far we go back with the recording. And there are a few in the 17th and late 16th centuries. The numbers begin to pick up significantly in the early to mid 18th century. And we have, I think, until 1790, about 130 some, something like that, which is a lot. That would really surprise most slavery scholars that we have approaching 130. By, if you say 17th, 18th century, I think we may be approaching 150. That would really surprise a lot of slavery scholars. The bulk are in the 19th century, and there are a few in the 20th century, people who were captured as children before the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade ended in 1867. So a few were captured as children in the late 1850s, early 1860s, and lived for a long time and were interviewed in the 19 teens or 30s or something when they were quite old.
Are there any themes that you found particularly striking in the different narratives, maybe things that similarities between certain stories that you found particularly revealing about the experience of people in slavery?
I would say my first thought is no, and that's why this collection is so interesting and important, because what you're getting is tremendous diversity in these individual experiences. We really do focus on the individual in this collection. And they're unique, all of them. You have 490 different stories. Everyone was on a slave ship. So, yes, but we already knew that. I mean, that's the question is what happens to people on slave ships? And it's a tremendous diversity of experience even there. Resistance was much more widespread and varied than most people would realize. There is a trend in scholarship in recent years among the special of this to stress that there was more resistance on the slave ships than people thought earlier, and in different ways. And this sort of contributes to that movement. But what I see is it's much more significant and diverse, widespread than anything I've ever read in scholarship on the slave ship experiences. And the rest of it, it's, you know, it's not a monograph arguing some thesis about what the transatlantic slave trade was all about. It's a catalog. It's a collection of all of these materials, and so you can study all kinds of things with it. And I've attempted two or three things myself that are pretty interesting and striking, I think, studies of what happened to people based on these African voices, and hopefully other people will do the same. But it's almost unlimited what you can do with it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Are there any narratives featured in it that you found particularly fascinating, or you know, maybe a narrative that if someone is wants to check this book out that you would recommend that they read just to get a sense of what the experience might have been like for one of the people featured in it?
Oh, many.
If there's one,
suppose for a beginner, if you're trying to get hooked on it, you would want to avoid some of the shorter ones that are just a couple of sentences. You want to come to those after you've already been hooked and you're interested in a topic. So maybe you want to study children or something, and so you want to look at all of them, and including those that are just a couple of sentences to get some help. But I'll just give you one example. I was thinking of this the other day. A man whose European-American name was Thomas Fuller. We don't have his African name. A lot of times we do, and in the catalog, we give the African name first and then what other names they acquired in slavery later. And sometimes it's three or four different names. But for Fuller, all we have is his English name. And he was taken to Virginia from West Africa in the late colonial period, in the 1750s, I believe. Yes. He was quite old in the 1790s when he gave his account such as it was, and it was published. And one of the names he acquired was the African calculator. They literally called him that. And or some people called him the Virginia calculator. That became one of his names in addition to Thomas Fuller. He was a mathematical genius. He was enslaved on a plantation in Northern Virginia. I believe he was in Georgetown, actually. And people began hearing about him and his mathematical capabilities. And Benjamin Rush, the famous doctor, enlightened thinker, writer, was in a group connected to the American Philosophical Society, the publishers of the book, actually. And they heard about him, and they went to see him to see what this guy could do. And they talked to him, and they gave him some calculations, and they recorded all of his responses, and that was published almost immediately. And within a few years, it was published in various newspapers and formats, and we tracked them all down. So it's not Fuller telling about his life in Africa or what happened to him on the slave ship. He doesn't really even tell about his life in the Americas. But he responds to their questions, and he talks to them, and they record it. And he is telling about his life indirectly by performing all these calculations. And there's an anecdote they give there. One of the questions they asked him was something like, how many seconds there are in a 12-year period? And in no time at all, he gave them an answer. And they took several minutes themselves to check it out. And they said, no, you're wrong. You have too many seconds. You're wrong. And Fuller replied, no, you're wrong. You forgot to include leap year. So they recalculated with leap year and found out Fuller was exactly right. And he was enslaved on this plantation. I can't remember if it was a plantation or in the town of Georgetown. I think it was in the town of Georgetown. So he may have been urban domestic slave, but still he was enslaved. And it was an old man, had been there for a long time, been through the revolution, and experienced so much, experienced the slave ship. There's no demonstrated connection, but I've seen references in scholarship to an area in West Africa. We know he's from West Africa. We don't know where, but there is a place and a people who are renowned for their mathematical abilities. It's just what they do, and they emphasize. Maybe he came from that area. I don't know. And sometimes you can have a lot of fun with this kind of work. It's a gruesome subject, but in other ways, it's uplifting. You know, who knows? You can speculate wildly. If you saw the movie Hidden Figures, where did the calculators? They called people calculators in the movie as well. Where did they come from? Virginia. Makes me wonder if there's not a connection. Maybe even back to that area in West Africa. That's wild speculation, but you know, what the hell?
I mean, that's it. That's a fascinating theory. It would be really interesting to see how someone would go about studying something like that. But I appreciate that anecdote about Thomas Fuller. It's really interesting. And obviously, you know, hearing these kind of individual stories that you've collected, you know, and seeing these stories that you've collected, it really just does highlight that, you know, oftentimes when studying history, you know, we're looking at the big sweep of things, and we forget the individuals that are involved in the stories. Yeah. You know, we remember that, you know, the famous individuals, politically powerful, rich people, but not the other people that either, you know, people that are oppressed or just everyday, everyday people. You know, you've mentioned, and I think it's also very clear from the book that, you know, this is in many ways meant to be a sort of educational tool, educational resource, or a place that someone who's working on a, you know, let's say like a senior thesis project or a master's degree or really even a book, might find the information in here very useful. So I was wondering if there's any suggestion or any thought that you have to how someone could use 500 African Voices in the classroom or elsewhere.
Right. And I can say two things about that. One, you're thinking the way I'm thinking, and I'll give you some examples of students I've already had, undergraduate and graduate students, working on it in that way. But before I do that, Robert Hansard has a much different way of thinking about it. He teaching over at Columbia College, he's a lot more tech savvy than I am. He likes to teach and work with students doing audiovisual projects. And he's already had since over a year his students creating these fascinating audiovisual projects with these African voices. So a student just picks one person, one story that they get interested in, read the material on their lives, and construct. It's like a cartoon in a way, but it takes artistic ability on their behalf. So someone who's more artistically inclined might choose this option, and they just tell their story and narrate it themselves and have these figures and these individuals doing various things, and you're seeing how this collection, these voices, or a particular voice, just sort of reached out and grabbed essentially an artist who created this audiovisual material. And we are going to develop a website eventually. Now that the book is out, that's the next big step. And we'll have these audiovisual creations from his students as part of the website whenever we get there. As for me, it's and students I've worked with, just last semester, last fall, I had three students in a research seminar on Atlantic worlds work with these materials and come up with some really interesting projects. One of them was about African first encounters with white people, with Europeans, based on the African voices. We have a literature focuses primarily on the 15th and 16th century of first encounters of European explorers moving into Africa or new areas for them in the Americas, encountering Native Americans, and what were their very initial impressions. And they're revealing in all kinds of ways. So this is just kind of the converse of that. Get inside the African perspective with their voices and their first descriptions with their first encounters and with Europeans, whenever that might have been. And those are very revealing of the culture and the place from African perspectives as well.
My final question is if there is anything else that you're working on or any other project related to this that you are seeking out to also work on?
Quite a few, actually. We want to develop the website, and it will become essentially part of a relational database linked to other websites on transatlantic slavery, international websites, and there's a large and growing number.
Do you know what the website URL is, or has it not been created?
Oh, we're not that far along yet.
Okay.
All we have now is that many of the, with the catalog, you get a brief bibliographic description, you get a one-paragraph biography of the African. You get a complete print history of the publication from the first, which dates back to the 18th century in some cases, to the present. And then we have URLs and QR codes that take you to the full text of the account. And whenever we didn't have a full text available, easily available and free on the internet, we don't want people to have to pay money to be able to read these. About half of them you can get through HathiTrust or Internet Archive, various ways, and they are free. The other half were not. So we created a commons site at my university, Northern Illinois University, and we have all the texts there. And so that's, I suppose, the beginning of the website for us, but that's all we have. But we want to have a full-blown website with all of the material we have, all of the maps, the creative work that Robert's students are doing, a lot more images than we already have, and we want to link it to other international transatlantic slavery websites. So if you're interested in someone who came from, say, somewhere in Sierra Leone, you could you click on that individual, you read all of our information, and you would see a link to other websites that give you a lot more information about Sierra Leone related to the history of transatlantic slavery. So that's one project. Another project is, for me personally, and I haven't heard Robert mention this, but I think he'll do something along these lines eventually, is I'm writing articles about this, scholarly articles arguing this or that. I've published one so far, and I've got a draft of another and two or three others that are in the works, so I want to write articles based on people and information that I'm getting out of this. One was about, the one that's published was about Africans appropriating rhetoric of the age of revolutions, of Christianity, of Islam, to critique transatlantic slavery. There some discussion in literature about whether this happened or if it did, who was doing it. Was it, it must have been just elites or something. And I found that a lot of people who were in a position to doing, to appropriate revolutionary rhetoric. In other words, to say, well, if all men are created equal, if freedom is a good thing, then give me my freedom. Slavery is wrong, and you've got me enslaved. So a lot of people did that. And they weren't just elites. They were quite common, ordinary people. The view that it's some people who somehow got out of slavery and then were taken care of by abolitionists or others and lived special, relatively elite lives thereafter. They're there, but there are a lot of ordinary people who never got out of hard times for the rest of their lives that also embraced revolutionary rhetoric, for example, and used it to critique slavery. And also, I am writing a monograph called Immigrant Voices that's to be a synthesis of 4 centuries of forced and free transatlantic migrations. And the immigrant voices for the Europeans are letters that they wrote home that have been published or digitized. And then for the Africans, who until about 1820 were the majority of all the transatlantic migrants since Columbus, I use this collection of African voices for that.
This all sound like wonderful and valuable projects. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. The book is 500 African Voices, a catalog of published accounts by African enslaved in the transatlantic slave trade from 1586 to 1936 from the American Philosophical Society Press. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I think it's been a bit.